Welcome, welcome, welcome to Nodes in the Net, a weekly tangential, irreverent conversation that caters to the interests of liminal trickster mystics like you and like Amos J. Hunt, who you will recognize as a return guest to the Nodes in the Net podcast. Amos and I have talked previously about his literary magazine, Grub Street Grackle, which you'll be able to find at creekmasons.substack.com. And today, we had kind of a less structured conversation about the trials and tribulations of being a writer and generally being a creative person. This is kind of a prescient episode in that I recorded it, or I guess we recorded it many months ago, before all of the hype began to rise for internal family systems therapy modalities in the Creek Mason Discord. And since then, we've been talking about that a lot with books like Feed Your Demons and Robert Falconer's appearance on Guru's Passing Through podcast and all sorts of good stuff like that. And so we are going to discuss that today. We'll get a bit of a deep dive into the intricacies of the parts that comprise Amos. And, you know, I kind of maybe overstepped my boundaries as a podcast host a little bit and tried to offer some therapy in this episode, which, of course, I don't know. Hopefully it was welcome. you tell me how you thought it was received by heading to creekmasons.substack.com and clicking the initiate yourself link to join the Discord. And while you're there, why don't you please subscribe to the newsletter so that you can get notifications about new Nodes in the Net posts and new essays like the one that I am about to read an excerpt from right now. This is an essay entitled You Belong With Me. She wears short skirts, I wear t-shirts, she's cheer captain and I'm on the bleachers. And that's from the song You Belong With Me by Taylor Swift. It's a pop anthem about alienation, and it was once unavoidable, even ubiquitous. You might infer that that means that feelings of alienation are too. That conclusion has an ironic implication. We belong everywhere, even when we bring our feelings of self-isolating self-doubt with us. T. Swivy's You Belong With Me was blasting at a gas station I pulled up to the other day. I was listening to Stephen Cope's Yoga and the Quest for the True Self, queued up to the end of one of the more esoteric chapters. It was about Kundalini energy, sometimes referred to as Riz, charisma, by my Gen Alpha daughter, as in, you have zero Riz, Dad. Ouch, but fair. Because when I pulled up to the gas station and was confronted by this Swiftie blasting a mainstream song about othering, I made eye contact and let my generally obscure metaphysical text chapter finish. I'm not saying I cranked the volume antagonistically like an elitist who thinks his hipster-esque hyperfixation on spiritual awakening makes him a better person. It just was loud from the freeway, and I didn't hide myself ashamed either. In the past, I might have felt that kind of aversion. I might have excluded myself and felt ostracized through my own insistence on unusual interests. I'd have covered that up with snobbery, projecting my uncomfortably visceral sense of alienation onto the Swiftie, and telling a story to myself that my superiority to her pop music was the source of my icky internal feelings. Really, I'd just be feeling bad all by myself. I'd be in pain, lonely, self-averted. My knee-jerk, probably unconscious reaction would be, "You loser, you can't just like the things that would make you likable." The unexamined thought I'd use to hide from that reflex would be, "What a shame to be surrounded by idiot normcore muggles." If feeling like I belong with others is expansive, that kind of self-directed shutting off is contraction. It's misaligned contraction, out of balance, unconscious and shadowy, a toxic explosion of self-aversion that could potentially be avoided. And you can read the rest of that essay on creekmasons.substack.com, and of course the links to find Amos and Grub Street Grackle will be there as well. As I mentioned, I recorded this episode months ago, but didn't get a chance to post it until now, thanks to the glorious help of the one and only Colin Reinagall, who's also been on Nodes in the Net, and who you know as CJ on the Creek Mason Discord. Colin was able to salvage the audio on this conversation to such a degree that I think it's basically impossible to notice that anything was wrong with it in the first place. Colin's work on this episode is invaluable, and I really appreciate it because I think this conversation was really fun, and it would have sucked to have to kind of trash can it because I lack the skills to do anything about the audio problems that we had encountered due to technical difficulties. I don't think I have anything else to say. I will see you next week. You beat me to it.
Sucka.
Nice. I love that. Welcome. Welcome, welcome. Doing? Amos, you're a full-on Creek Mason, so you know the secret initiatory handshake of shouting welcome at people. That's one of our main ways of ensuring that people are completely caught off guard. It's kind of like an aggressive friendliness.
I just wanted to see if I could ruin the episode right at the beginning. That's...
yeah.
That way, whatever happens doesn't matter.
Yeah. Right. All 20 of the listeners of Notes in the Net have already logged off.
Yep.
So there's no pressure. It's just you and me just talking me and you now. Yeah.
As it should be.
And we drew the Eight of Wands. So that's, do you know that card? Are you on the Creek Mason Discord right now?
No, I turned it off. Let me just, I'll just Google it or DuckDuckGo it.
Yeah. So it's a very like visually simple card. Yeah, it's kind of silly looking. It's just like eight wands flying through the air at different, you know, rates, I guess, or they're flying from left to right across the card. And it just looks like someone threw them. They're kind of on the descent. And it's like, there's not much that you can get from this card other than like movement and change and action. I like to think of it lots of times as having a lot of like balls in the air, you know, like it's a card that's like you got a lot going on, you know. Wands is the willpower element, or suit, I guess I should say. It's associated with the fire element, which are all kind of like expressing your will. I think the like suit of wands from Ace to Ten kind of describes the process of beginning. For me, it seems like beginning like a creative project or something like that, something that you're generating things into the world. And one of the stages, it's almost like a graphic novel. And like the eighth panel of the graphic novel is you take on more tasks than you probably can handle. That's always how it's felt to me. Does that resonate?
100%. Yeah, that's me in a nutshell, isn't it?
Yeah. Do you have that problem where you like like this is the thing that I always do. Like I get really pumped on, you know, the juices of like beginning something and starting to get into my flow, and I just like start vacuuming in like I'm gonna, you know, start taking cold showers and, you know, 15 other habits that like all at once.
Yeah, it's the toad thing, right? Wind in the Willows.
What's that from?
Have you ever read Wind in the Willows?
No.
I don't know if I'm going to remember the details. The character Toad just keeps getting into things for a few months at a time, and then declares that's for suckers, and now he's into this other thing.
Mm.
Yeah, the TikTok calls it hyperfixation.
I think he's the first ADHD character in children's literature.
Yeah, we love our representation.
Yeah, but Eight of Wands sounds like it's almost the opposite of hyperfixation because it's about having a bunch of stuff going on at the same time.
Yeah, it kind of feels like trying to keep all the things in the air at once. That's what it reminds me of. Like you've got a lot going on, you know, and you're trying to keep all of it flying forward, you know.
It's interesting. You've got a very dynamic interpretation of that picture. The wands are flying or falling or going somewhere, but to me, it just looks like they're just kind of sitting there. How I feel about all of my projects. I have a lot going on, you could say, but not much happening.
Mm. Yeah, you know, now that you mention it, like the little leaves on the wands aren't like, you know, tucked back like they're being, you know, blown against the breeze or whatever. It does kind of feel like there's a stillness to it. What's got you blocked? What are your projects and you know, like let's deep dive into your psychology.
Are we gonna do therapy right now?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay.
If you're down.
I don't know, Jeff. I don't know what my problem is. I've been trying to identify the different parts of myself that are fighting against each other. And there are quite a few of them, and my therapist says that each of them is trying to protect me from something. But it feels more to me like each of them is their own snidely whiplash, you know, twirling his mustaches, the railroad tracks. They're all villains in my head. I've got the poet mystic. I think poet mystic are maybe actually two different people. Because the poet doesn't mind lying if it sounds good. And the mystic is trying to live in truth. So, but they're mostly allied, right?
Poet, yeah.
Mystic.
Mm-hmm.
And when I'm in that territory, that's when I really feel like me. So I do tend to picture all of the other parts of myself that aren't poet or mystic as evil blockers. So there's the scientific materialist in me, who, whenever the mystic says stuff like, you know, everything's an illusion or anything could happen, the scientific materialist pops up to dismiss that childish garbage.
Yeah, and the Daniel Dennett kind of like career skeptic or James Randi, I think is his name, the guy who took all those.
I'm pretty sure those guys pills. Are way smarter than my scientific materialist.
Okay. Yeah, yours is just like an annoying naysaying.
Yeah, he's just a Redditor.
Yeah.
Because it's really easy for the ontologist in me to come at scientific materialist and say, look, the stuff you're saying is not even internally coherent. Like, you think everything is matter? Well, what's that?
Right? Yeah.
It's wet.
Yeah.
The whole concept falls apart very quickly, but it doesn't matter because it's not a philosophy. It's an attitude. So, okay, Jeff, what's the scientific materialist trying to protect me from? He won't let me write poetry. He won't let me like have a spiritual practice. He won't let me, he won't let me read books. Basically won't let me do anything cool. So what's he protecting me from?
Cool stuff, I guess. Like what are the dangers of cool stuff?
I might have a good time. That's how it looks to me. No, I do have a one thought about it, which is that I'm afraid of being fooled and being used. That accounts for at least part of it, because I've seen how spirituality, broadly speaking, can be weaponized, can be turned mm-hmm. to all kinds of nefarious purposes, and I don't want to be part of that.
Yeah.
So that's the only thing I can think of, but it doesn't really make sense of the whole thing, because then I should at least be able to strike out into the wilderness spiritually and be my own guru, my own spiritual teacher, and figure it out. And what's the harm in that? And I think actually that's the scientific materialist doesn't have much to say about that. It's more the theologian. And I call him Tommy Q. I'm trying to come up with names for each of them.
Yeah, it's a good idea.
So Tommy Q has a strong predisposition against spiritual exploration, free spiritual inquiry, just building the ship of religion for myself or something like that.
Mm.
Because that's self-indulgent hippie stuff. And why be Robinson Crusoe when the city is already built right over here? It's called the church, you dummy. Like, just
yeah.
But I can't do that either.
Yeah, it's kind of like your joiner part. It's the scientific materialist guy kind of seems to want you to be a loner, and the theologian part kind of seems to want you to be a joiner. It sounds like the same tension between belonging and alienation that I've been feeling lately, or at least somehow similar.
I do have that conflict between being a joiner, being a loner, but these two guys, they don't care what I do, really.
Mm.
It's about the framework of belief supporting the action.
Mm.
So the Tommy Q really wants me to have that.
Yeah.
And to know that all the stuff I used to know about God.
Mm. So you grew up like attending church?
Yeah.
What's that like? I didn't. I grew up an atheist. Yeah. Mm.
Well, I don't know. How do you say what something is like that you grew up with? Because it's just, that's what life is like.
Yeah. Well, the theologian wants you to return to it. There must have been something enticing about it, right?
Honestly, the Tommy Q doesn't have a lot of respect for the church that I grew up in, because that was the evangelical free church. And there were some pretty brainy pastors, don't get me wrong, but it wasn't like reading Duns Scotus or Aquinas or something like that. It was more about, they had the slogan, building community to reach the community. And the whole thing was about just that, just like, we're going to get more people in the door. What are those people going to do when they get in the door? They're going to get more people in the door. Like, at least that's how it felt to me as a 15-year-old starting to think about things critically. And, you know, keep in mind, everything I say is a 15-year-old's perspective on the evangelical free church, and therefore very two-dimensional, probably not fair. But, yeah, it's confusing because it was my whole community. I was very active in the youth group. All my friends were in the youth group. And, that's not true. A lot of my friends and this strong community, and a recursive growth machine.
Yeah.
That whose only point was to feed itself.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'm.
Well, presumably they wanted to feed itself because that would be more people being saved and getting into heaven or whatever, right? Like, or is there like kind of the deep self aversion that exists everywhere in capitalism that's like a shame that there's never enough, that it's like it's more of an addiction to growth for growth's sake in order to fill a hole that is left by, I don't know, by doubt, I guess. In a lot of cases, it seems like it's a hole that's created by like a lack of conviction or a lack of believing that there is a like a reason for us to exist. I don't know. That's a hot take, I guess, but
well, there's maybe I can see how you went there based on my description, but mm-hmm. No, definitely wasn't any kind of lack of conviction, because that's almost all we had. Like I knew that my friends who weren't in the youth group were going to hell.
Mm.
That if I couldn't convince them to join, that was it for them. And so yeah, I did. I this sense of responsibility to save people from hell was a big part of my life.
Yeah, that's a lot of responsibility.
And I couldn't do it. I never convinced anybody.
Oh yeah.
Oh. In fact, eventually I couldn't convince myself anymore.
Yeah. Well, I'll welcome you to the hell of not belonging in the church.
But I stopped being afraid of hell, though.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. I'll tell you about that later. But the this probably sounds like splitting hairs to someone who didn't grow up with religion. But the part of me that still identifies with the evangelical upbringing is totally different from the theologian.
Mm.
Those are almost opposed parts of myself, because
interesting,
theologian wants things to make sense intellectually, wants the whole spiritual realm to be philosophically coherent.
Mm.
And
yeah, like Thomas Aquinas. I think he's famous for like creating maps of revelation or whatever. Like if an angel appears to you on a Tuesday, then it's this kind of revelation. However, if it happens at night, then it's this kind, right? Isn't that that was one of his contributions to religious philosophy.
I've never read Aquinas on specifically, so
it's very mathy.
Yeah. Have you read Aquinas?
A long time ago, like for a college course.
When I read Aquinas, I get a thrill at how much sense it makes.
Mm.
And how evident the love for truth is in the thinking. And there's a whole edifice of thought built around that love of truth, which I think it's fair to call wisdom.
Hmm.
And yeah, it's foolish to reject wisdom, like by definition.
Yeah. Right.
But here I am.
Mm-hmm. Trying to come up with your own wisdom, trying to figure out what's wise for yourself. Because it's dangerous to accept someone else's idea of wisdom. What if they convince you that it's really wise to give them all of your money and you know, or I mean, like, I've been listening to the Here and Now podcast, like Ram Dass's lectures, and there's one where he's talking about the like groovy idea of like surrendering to live on a commune, and like some person, you know, wakes you up every day and tells you what your job is going to be for that day, and your whole job is to just surrender to it and wear the overalls and do the farming and try to be present, you know, throughout. And, you know, whoa, what a far out idea it would be to just completely give up your autonomy to someone else. And I don't know. That just doesn't, that's like, sounds kind of scary. Sounds kind of like not what I want to do. I think also, though, there's something about the way that you framed it, where it's actually more about the philosophies and the, yeah, like the like rationale that is behind. It's I guess maybe less of like an intuitive kind of emotional fear of being taken advantage of, and more of like a, well, what if I don't have the very best idea? It's like the quality of the idea that, yeah, pulls you away from. Is that? Am I on,
yeah,
the right track?
Yeah, it's like you know, if you're wrong about what is, then how can you make good choices?
Mm.
Right? Stupid contrived example. What are you drinking?
It's a yerba mate. Is it making, okay, a lot of noise? I hope it's not getting picked,
no,
up by the mic.
I want to use that in my example. So if there's nothing in the can, or let's say there's piss in the can, and I said it was going to be contrived. Okay, so say the can is full of piss. You believe, mm-hmm, that it's full of yerba mate. That belief is going to be harmful to you because now you're going to drink this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't want to do that.
So it's kind of an obvious thing that if you have the wrong beliefs, you'll make the wrong choices. You'll make choices that you'll regret. Perhaps only in the long run, right? Not in that example, you'll know right away that you drank this, but if you're drinking a slow poison, you might not know until tomorrow, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think both the theologian Tommy Q and, oh, I thought I had a cute nickname for the scientific materialist too. I'm gonna ask Natalie later. Anyway, they're both trying to protect me from some kind of slow poison, right? They're each of them thinks in his own way that I have, that I'm neglecting some obvious truth that I already know, either that everything is just ultimately lifeless, particles, Democritus and atoms and void, or, that everything is, the working out of the will of an omnipotent, omniscient, benevolent one God, whose revelation is promulgated in a consistent way through the teachings of the Catholic Church, founded by Jesus Christ and maintained by his apostles in an unbroken succession,
yeah,
etc.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, so, I mean, what is the poison of, forgetting that everything is just dead particles? Like, what sorts of decisions could you make that would, you know, kill you over time if you forgot that, you know, everything is just,
I suppose,
meaningless matter?
You might, invest energy in something that doesn't exist. You might invest personal energy time, resources, and mental energy.
Attention.
Yeah. So in spirit. And if spirit doesn't exist, there's no such thing as spirit, then you could waste half your life trying to relate to persons that aren't there when there's real life happening around you all the time. And maybe there's, you know, ultimately, of course, the problem is that real life doesn't matter either.
I was just going to say, like, I mean, ultimately, you just return to being dead matter, that, like, you return to wherever I was last Tuesday that I no longer remember, wherever I was before I was born. Yeah. Like,
that's why I say the scientific materialist in me is not that smart, right? He he just stops thinking when you get to that point.
he sits back and lets one of the other parts take over from there.
Oh, no, he shouts them down.
Oh, okay.
Right.
He sounds like kind of a jerk.
Using the tools of mockery, contempt, just talking more, being louder. That's how he is.
Yeah. But I mean, he's on your side. He doesn't want you to waste your life. That's thanks, little buddy. I don't want to waste my life either.
Right. I think he's probably the part of me that's least helpful most of the time. But I'm not going to get rid of him. I don't think.
No.
So I don't think. I gotta like.
I don't think it works like that.
The little buddy attitude. Like I gotta say, you know, little Mini Dawkins or whatever his name is. he can be like a pet, like a yippy little dog that's always.
Yeah. Right.
I've got a cat that bites my toes. That's where my mind goes. It's just this creature that comes around and annoyingly bites your toes because it loves you.
Yeah.
And that's why I don't kick the cat. And you know, that might be the best that I can do with this guy.
I mean, I have a dog I just got pretty recently, like in the last couple months. It's like a Chihuahua mix. So I have like a yappy little dog, and it like when you hold it for some reason, it's almost like a cat's purr. It just growls all the time. And it like, it'll be, you know, like licking your face, giving you kisses at the same time that it's growling. So it's like, it's definitely not, pissed or like aggressive or dangerous, as far as I know. I'm not an expert in dog psychology, but it seems to be like part of its lovingness involves like just grumbling all the time and being kind of like rah, rah, in like kind of a upsetting way, like disturbing and off-putting. It kind of makes you want to put the dog down, but the dog is like, you know, like licking your face the whole time. So there's also this communication from it that it's enjoying your cuddles or your little hug or whatever. And it is little, you know, I think that's a part of this like Redditor. I don't know. For me, when I think of Redditors, I think of myself when I was that was my 15-year-old personality. Just a dumb little guy, you know, just a little dumb teenager, you know, who like grumbles and is kind of a misanthrope. And, I don't know where I'm going with that. It's definitely not going to end in a question, but That's
my 15-year-old self was more of a Bokonanist. You ever read Cat's Cradle by Kurt Vonnegut?
No, but my dad keeps trying to get me to read it though.
I don't know if I can recommend it because I haven't read it since I was a teen, but I think it's
good. Yeah.
But there's a religion in the book that everyone knows is made up.
Mm.
But that's fine. it's true because we made it up, something like that. I might be remembering it wrong, but that's how I, as I was, discovering that the evangelical church was not, working for me. It was not, but as I discovered that I couldn't live that way, I was daily inventing new spiritual truths for myself that I was able pretty much completely to believe as I was inventing them. and it just took it's like I was high all the time, and I never did drugs. But I would think like someone who was on drugs.
Yeah.
It just took me decades to come down. I miss that.
Yeah.
That's my mystic.
The mystic.
Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. Which is a part that you like continue to identify with. It's like, it's one of the parts that you want to give more control over, when it comes to, you know, who gets to drive the Amos vehicle.
Yeah. And even when I was, I converted to Catholic Church. 21, I think. 20. And I was pretty hardcore Catholic for quite a long time. But throughout that time, the mystic in me was always trying to trick Catholic doctrine into being what I wanted it to be.
Oh yeah.
So like I would read the catechism, basically just looking for expressions that were beautifully worded enough that some ambiguity could enter in, and I could kind of let it mean whatever was spiritually productive for me.
Yeah.
So, like, for example, early in the Catechism of the Catholic Church, it says that the amount of time I spent thinking about this, it's surprising I can't remember the exact wording, but it's something like there are foundational mysteries. The Trinity, for example, is a foundational mystery. And so I thought, well, what's a mystery? A mystery is something that no one can figure out, no one can understand. If everything is founded on a mystery, then the confidence that a lot of the more systematically minded Catholics around me seem to have couldn't possibly be justified. Everything that they believe with such fervor and confidence is founded on a mystery.
Right.
By definition, they don't understand. So I spent a lot of my time just thinking about the Trinity. That was like 90% of my Catholicism was just reflecting on these foundational mysteries.
I have a follow-up question for that. So the thing you just did that I thought was really interesting was you reduced the like Catholic religion the same way that you did the scientific materialist religion to like its fundamental basic component, which is like in the case of the atheist, it was like, you know, what's matter? Which is a mystery, right? That like when you get down to it, no matter what you believe, at the core, there needs to be some kind of assumption that can't be proven.
And you know who's doing this? Who's digging down to the root and pointing it out and saying, I could actually cut the whole thing down right here. That's the trickster.
Yeah.
The trickster. So I know we like the phrase liminal trickster mystic. That's a magical phrase. In my personal experience, mystic and trickster are allied, but not necessarily the same person. The trickster really just likes working for the mystic because the mystic is the underdog. because every time the mystic talks, everyone else looks down on him like he's the child in a room full of adults who really get it. So, I mean, that's how I always felt when I would say what I actually believed among other Catholics, or if I tried to speak to materialist types, I'd always feel sort of looked down on because I have these beliefs that that don't play in their frameworks, which they know are 100% true, and so it's by definition silly.
Yeah.
So just because of that dynamic, I think the trickster just likes to upset that. Just likes to say, "Oh, you think that you know what's what," and goes digging.
Yeah, it's the part of you that like prevents you from taking anything too seriously.
Yeah. So I mean, if the mystic ever won out, I imagine that the trickster would still be there. Just kind of flicking his ear or something. I don't know how you trouble a mystic, really. Maybe you can't.
Yeah. I mean, I think the mystic just, I don't know, would kind of enjoy the ear flicking. Like, oh yeah, haha, I am being a little silly, you know? It's like, I did make these beliefs up myself, and they are, you know, maybe only applicable to me, and they are just as absurd as anything else that anyone, you know, just because I made them up doesn't mean they're any better than anyone else's.
Yeah, I have one of those. Can I tell you an example of an absolutely ridiculous belief that I have that I know doesn't apply to anyone else?
Yeah.
I believe it for myself, which is that if you're a prime number age,
okay,
then anything can happen and you can change in radical ways. Because prime numbers are wobbly. Like numbers with a lot of factors are very stable because they have a lot of dimensions, and so you can just kind of set them down on the table. But a prime number is shaped like this at the base, and it's going to topple over if you try to set it down.
Yeah.
So because I'm 41 right now, I have, just because of this belief and not because of any evidence in my life, because if I look at my own behaviors and I look at what's happening and how I feel, I'll be in despair about moving forward and changing things. But I do have hope for myself because I'm 41. And I've talked to other people about this, and they've confirmed that for them, this absolutely doesn't bear out because they've had very radical changes during composite years of their life. And but I don't know. I believe it anyway for myself.
Yeah. And of course, like the trickster could attack that if that belief started to take itself too seriously. It could say, you know, I don't know, what's a prime number anyway? This whole math thing is made up. The number of revolutions around the sun is only something that we started counting recently, or I don't know. Like there's a way to tear it down, but like there's a way I feel like to measure things based on their impact or their outcome rather than their foundation. And like, I guess in the long run, you never know whether it's going to be a slow poison But you can know that, like, if you took one of these wands that's flying through the air that you described as projects, but now I'm thinking are actually parts, the wands that are arrayed on the Eight of Wands might be. It could be both. Could be either. Could be.
Because what I wanted to say.
Yeah.
Well, I'll come back to it because you're in the middle of a sentence.
No, go ahead. I wasn't going anywhere.
That I have a lot of creative projects and personal development projects and household projects that I set for myself, but that aren't going anywhere. And that's how those wands in the picture look.
Yeah,
they're up in the air, but they're also just sitting. So mm-hmm. I started a novel that I really liked the idea of writing it.
Yeah.
Stuck on the same paragraph for like a year.
Yeah.
I can't let go of it either. And what else? I've got several text adventure games I want to write. I've got books that I've started reading. I've got things that I started learning. Fully intending to clean out the garage as I have been for about 10 years now.
Yeah. Yeah. So
there's hundreds of things like that in my life. I simply cannot move forward on. And that's where the parts come in, is that if I picked any one of those, I could probably identify with some thought what the parts are that are frustrating that project.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a tension between parts. Like, some of the parts really like the project and want to move forward with it and won't let you let go of it. And the other parts are like, no, we're not going to waste our time on this.
Yeah, it just feels like that tension is in perfect equilibrium in all these areas. Like, just wish one of them could just win.
Yeah. It'd almost be better for either side to win.
Yeah.
Being torn between two options, you know, is almost more uncomfortable and more stagnant, which then, I don't know, I'm not trying to like make you feel bad or anything, but that, like, then aren't you really, like, isn't that the waste? isn't that ultimately the biggest waste, is you spend your life torn?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah,
but I seem to be committed to wasting my life.
Is there a part that specifically, like, wants you to have a life that is, what's the word, productive, meaningful? Is there a part that's like, it's really important that while you're alive, X happens?
Yeah. And I don't know what to call that part. I mean, maybe that's just me. I wonder if that's the inner child, because your children look forward to the future and have ideas of what their adult life is going to be like. And they think it's going to be something. I definitely thought I was going to be something.
Yeah. The part that has, like, high standards for you, or big ambitions, or
the main character energy.
Yeah, right. The like foundling, you know, who's like working on the farms, and then the dragon egg falls from the sky or whatever, you know, and then he goes off to ride dragons and save the world. You know, I don't know. For me, that's a big part of what it was when it came to, like, I mean, this becomes like kind of a messiah complex thing, but that idea that I would be discovered and plucked from my boring suburban life and into some sort of meaningful, fulfilling, you know, hero narrative. It's, yeah. I think we're brainwashed, especially people around our age, with, like, you know, the kinds of movies that were coming out when we were developing our minds were all very like hero myth.
Right. Right. And I was super aware of that as a kid. Like, and I, at a certain point, refused to watch Disney movies precisely because I was so disgusted by the, this kind of fantasy, discovering a true self that, that has no objective correlative, in your actual person.
Yeah.
And yet, I definitely thought that way.
Yeah. It's kind of like a hyper-masculine thing. Like, you're gonna, you know, punch life right in the jaw and, like, you know, dominate it and have a good experience of life. Whereas, like, I don't know, this is totally my own framing and maybe it doesn't resonate with you at all, but something I've been playing with a little bit lately is the idea that instead of, like, earning my experiences or, like, earning a life that is worthwhile, it's like I just kind of receive from the universe the worthwhileness that already exists. Like, there's a innate, like, the innate quality of an infinite universe is abundance because it's infinite. And, you know, the innate quality of the universe, if you meditate long enough, is infinite love or, you know, unconditional positive regard or whatever you want to call it. It's like, everything is meaningful. I don't know if you've ever taken acid, but it kind of makes you feel, or made me feel like, or made someone I know, I have never taken acid, but someone I know told me about this. the feeling is like being a baby again, and you're experiencing everything with new eyes, and suddenly everything is in metaphor. It's like the color that the world is painted with is meaning. And yeah, I think, like, this has nothing to do with, like, actual gender, like, you know, either social construct or genitals or anything like that. But, like, the divine feminine idea is to be receptive to that energy, rather than, like, trying to earn a meaningful life. You just kind of allow your life to be perfect as it already is. And that's been on my mind a lot lately.
I'm trying to put the pieces of that together. Well, yeah, I find everything you just said very attractive. But, like, okay, so the mystic in me wants to say that the perception that you described that's about how things actually are. Nothing is itself. Everything is. I don't know if metaphor is the right word, but we'll say it, a metaphor for everything else.
Yeah.
But that relates to this idea of receptivity.
How that relates to what? Can you say it again?
The idea of receptivity, of just accepting the.
Oh, receptivity. Yeah. Rightness of life as it is. Well, the idea is that, like, the masculine urge is to, like, make meaning, to create meaning where there is none, and to kind of, like, earn through achievement and productivity and building things and doing stuff that's, like, you know, worthwhile. You earn a good life. And then the receptivity part is, like, you know, everything is everything else. I like, you know, that's a good way to put it. Like, it's kind of an Indra's net concept where, like, my friend who took acid wrote, "Help, everything is in metaphor," on a piece of paper and pinned it to the wall. Except he ran out of space. So the, like, last four letters of metaphor were smaller. And that became a metaphor. And then the fact that it was pinned to the wall was a metaphor. and the fact that it was written in pencil and slanting a little bit, like everything about it just felt incredibly referential to other aspects of creation. And when it comes down to it, that is kind of that's at least the New Agey way of looking at things, is they're all like the Indra's Net idea, the jewels have contained within them the reflection of every other jewel. And so that, like, that piece of paper contained within it the reflection of all the things to which it metaphorically referred. And so that's kind of like, it's kind of, I don't know, you hear about Ram Dass talk about it, like the psychedelics remove some of the barriers to recognizing that fundamental nature of things. Like,
because you can't see something that you don't see. So if you're seeing everything as everything else, that's because everything is everything else. The reason that you didn't see it when you weren't on acid, your friend wasn't on acid, it's just that, like, some part of your brain was blocking that. And probably, for some good reason, to make you functional.
And so instead of, like,
the same as seeing the truth, despite what the pedants in my head are telling me.
Pedants, it's okay. We don't need to we don't need to function and win a meaningful life. We need to just allow everything to be connected and to somehow.
No, I mean, like, the opposite. I mean, that we don't need to see the truth in order to function. In fact, we need not to see the truth.
Yeah.
That's the only way you can get food.
But you
forget that food is also music. Or, you forget that breath is also, I don't know, your family or something.
It's also my right sock, It doesn't even have to be, it doesn't even have to be something like profound. My computer screen. All things are all things.
But now I know there's only one thing. We finally got to what I actually want to talk about. So maybe we have to, do this again, because this being otherness of being, calling that metaphor, and saying that things refer to each other, I think is already a suppression of the. It's interpreting away the truth by reducing it to reference. That's something that it's a mystery that I want to swim in.
Yeah. What do you think? Should we swim in it for a couple minutes, or I know you're in, like, which I think is just the coolest thing in the world. Your library has a podcast studio. So I don't know if you have, like, other people who are going to, like, bang down the door if you're not out of there in time, or
no one else is coming in here, but I did promise my family I was going to be home. So yeah,
well, you know what? I think it's like actually kind of poignant to not try to pick apart or analyze or make sense of that mystery in this podcast, because as your therapist, my prescription for you is to just allow mystery, like, be receptive to, at the core of any of these ideologies. I don't know. What therapist has prescriptions for people? That's like the wrong profession if you want to give prescriptions out. But, like, it feels like it has a pull to me that, like, that okay, little buddy, but I like just sunbathing in the radiant warmth of this unknowable, innate meaning that arises from unknowability, but it's hard. I know.
Well, I love getting prescriptions. I always take them at least for a minute. It's amazing that I've lived this long.
Yeah. Well, Amos, thank you. Thank you for joining me. Thank you for becoming a node twice over. Yeah. It's been a wonderful conversation. And I think it, like, it actually really did help develop my ideas of like all three of the qualities of a liminal trickster mystic. I think that we kind of covered all of them, which is really fun. I'm glad we did this. All right. I'll see you online.
Bye.
Oh, do you want to plug like Grub Street Grackle or anything like that before we go?
Everyone should go to grubstreetgrackle.com and find some good stuff to read. It's not updated very often. But you will find one of my stalled projects is a complete commentary on every line of every poem of William Butler Yeats.
I loved that.
What, 5 lines in at this point? After about a year, but who knows? Who knows? When you check it, there might be an update. You should check it every day and see if I've covered another line. And if I haven't, please email me at whatever my email address is, amos.j.hunt@gmail.com. Email me and say, why haven't you updated the blog? That's what I'd like you to do every day. Everyone who's listening to this, go to grubstreetgrackle.com.
Yeah, wonderful. I hope they do. All right. Bye, friend.